Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The Balance, the only sports talk show that gives a well-balanced diet of sports. Host Tom Marquis and the gang are ready to break down this week in sports. This is the one place where fanatics can come together and talk about their favorite teams. The Balance brings you an analytical breakdown of sports from a fan's point of view. So sit back and get ready. It's time for The Balance.
Boy's got a mouth like a cannon, always shooting it off.
I wish you could just shut your big yapper!
All right, my minions, welcome Saturday morning. Good morning to you. You have stumbled across the number one sports talk show in the world. My name's Tom Marquis, El Presidente. I am your fearless leader for the next 2 hours. We're going to guide you through some of the best and top sports stories, what the fans are talking about, and how they're talking about it, because here at The Balance, we bring it to you from the fans' point of view. So feel free to give us a call. Jump in the conversation anytime because this show's about you. 917-889-8516. Well, I tell you what. Are we on the downslide of this winter wonderland that we have found ourselves trapped in here in the Midwest? You've heard me talk about it every week. I think hopefully this is the last week I get to stop talking about the cold weather in Indianapolis. Do you realize that it was colder here yesterday than in Sochi, Russia, where the Winter Olympics are going on? Unbelievable. And speaking of Winter Olympics, of course, yesterday was last night was the opening ceremonies. You know what? Say what you want about the Olympics or what, you know, whatever political thing you want to say or, you know, not liking the sports or liking the sports. A fantastic opening night, opening ceremonies, and the use of animation and special effects were amazing as the athletes in the Parade of Nations would come up. There was a animation of a globe, perhaps you saw it, of the countries, and as they it looked literally as if they were walking out of this globe on to the stage. An incredible performance. So hats off to the country of Russia, you know, in the world spotlight, especially when there's so much negativity around Russia. And which, by the way, that was what the whole purpose of the Olympics was to begin with. Well, the Olympics from the country standpoint, not the Greek gods Olympics type situation, but was to bring countries together. And no matter what your political affiliation was, so, you know, my hat's off to Russia, and of course, go Team USA, and we'll get into a little bit more Olympic talk later on. But I tell you what, it is that time of year. It is 6 days till Daytona. That's right, so racing's back on the balance. Hot seat, front seat. We're here. You're on the pole, on the balance pole right here every Saturday morning, at least from 9 to 9:30. And as we get into full swing of racing and obviously get deep into NASCAR, IndyCar, and a lot to talk about, we'll probably extend it 9 to 10 as far as racing talk and that goes. I'll tell you what, this is an exciting time to be a part of the balance because, you know, not only this year are we going to be talking a lot of NASCAR, but we've got some other things to talk about as far as IndyCar and that sort of thing. This is going to be a good year if you're a race fan to be right here in the Balance Nation, to be a part of the Minion Nation. And if you're not, just go to Facebook, search The Balance, and hit like or follow us on Twitter at TBalance. My name's Tom Marquis, El Presidente. I'll tell you what, we have got a great show for you today, as always, as if we would ever have a bad show for you. Here, coming up here, we're going to have $2 Bill Josh joining us throughout the show today. We're going to be breaking down some racing, getting us back in the gear, getting us back in the seat you will. And so we're going to be talking some NASCAR, of course, Daytona, all the rumors and stuff around Daytona and what's going on there. Also, we're going to be talking a little IndyCar and the road course race, the Grand Prix of Indianapolis that's going to be going on at 9:30. Derek Schultz from 1260 AM, the Schultz Aquarius Show, is going to join us. We're going to be talking some college hoops, IU, Purdue, Big Ten. Guys, we get geared up toward March, and you can see March in the horizon. So we're going to be talking about that. And then at 10 o'clock, myself and $2 Bill Josh, we're going to be breaking down the NBA, going to be bringing back the NBA Zap. And really breaking down NBA. And, of course, here in Indianapolis, our Pacers are on fire this year, certainly on the road to a national championship. We're going to be talking in depth about the Pacers and their recent acquisitions. And, you know, of course, around the NBA. And then we'll throw in some Olympic talk to round things off today. So, as you can see, we're just getting started right here on The Balance. My name is Tom Marquis. El Presidente, we'll be right back.
And now back to your host for The Balance on...
Hi, I'm Mark Timmons of U.S. Water Systems, a family-owned Indiana company that sells water treatment equipment around the world. But we especially know Indiana water because our world headquarters are right here in Indy. You have bad water in your home or business? Whether you're on city or well water, uswatersystems.com makes it easy to solve your water problems. We offer videos, all sorts of water conditioning equipment, and tech support 365 days a year by certified water specialists. U.S. Water has reverse osmosis systems, water softeners, and salt-free water conditioners from $179. Visit us at uswatersystems.com.
Soccer is the world's game.
And it has deep roots in Indiana.
It lives in our backyard.
In our rec league.
In nuestras escuelas.
Indy 11 is here.
And make no mistake, this is Indiana's team.
It was built from the ground up.
Brick by brick by soccer fans.
When we take the field next April, we'll be playing for you.
For me. Para mí.
For us.
This is my team.
Este es mi equipo.
This is our team.
This is your team.
It's time.
It's going to be awesome.
I'm going to be there.
Voy a estar ahí. I'll be there.
This isn't just any soccer team. This is Indiana's team, and that includes you.
For over 100 years... the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has been the epicenter of racing, with the highest forms of motorsports all competing at Indy.
And Tony Kanaan has won the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500.
Over a century ago, the Speedway's designers had visions of a road course nestled inside the famed oval. And now, for the first time ever, the stars of the Indianapolis 500 will also run on the road course circuit.
It's so different than the Indy 500, I don't think it takes away from them. You can't even compare it to the oval. It's so different.
IndyCar drivers are the fastest and most versatile in the world. And now we'll be challenged by the 2.5-mile oval and the road course, both at the racing capital of the world.
Why not use this facility as much as you can? And this makes a lot of sense in my mind, and so if we have a chance to come here and race on the road course, hey, I'm all for it.
Next May, the racing action starts with the inaugural Grand Prix of Indianapolis.
It's pretty physical. There are a lot of fast corners. It's hard on your neck. Heavy braking into turn one. It's a good track.
This history-making event takes the green flag on Saturday, May 10, 2014. For the latest information, go to gpofindianapolis.com.
Back to your host for The Balance Online, Tom Marquis.
Fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
My minions, woohoo! Let's go racing! That's right, racing is back here on The Balance. so good to have you along. My name is Saul Marquis, El Presidente. Joining me also is Mr. $2 Bill Josh. Josh, how are we doing this morning? Are you ready to go racing, sir?
I am excited for this year's race. How are you today, Tom?
I am good. There we go. Something going on with the sound bites there, sir. I tell you what, though, it takes a little bit of getting back used into the groove of racing, that's for sure. So, Josh, what you been up to, my friend? We're going to get into some racing talk here in just a moment, but I know you've been off the show for a little bit, so what's been going on?
Well, this week I've been living off, you know, a little bit of maybe big-headedness. As I said on the show last week, when nobody else in America believed me, that Seattle would route Denver, and I texted you my projected score Sunday. Anyway, no, dude, it'll be way closer than that. In fact, it was a bigger blowout than I was projecting. That and watching a lot of NBA, so.
Well, I tell you what, I don't know if you've got some sort of crystal ball there. I don't think anybody but you was predicting that outcome of the Denver Broncos and the Super Bowl. But, hey, it's over with. We'll see what happens. We'll monitor the situation with Peyton Manning. But it's time to get into some racing. And you know what? Here's the thing about where we're at this year with NASCAR. A lot of different rule changes going on. And, you know, certainly those of you that like the chase, this is the year for you because, you know, one of the things that different people have been talking about is, hey, you know, there's not enough people there's not enough racers in the chase. This really isn't a chase. This really isn't competitive. I think with this new rule change, that will happen. Real quickly, what we're going to do here is we're going to take a minute and we're going to take a look at the 2014 rules change for the Sprint Cup Series.
It's a new year, new format, and new way to determine a champion in NASCAR. Starting in 2014, the chase for the NASCAR Sprint Cup increases from 12 to 16 drivers. The best way to qualify is to win. Each regular season winner gets a spot in what will be called the chase grid, provided he or she is in the top 30 in points and attempted to qualify for every race. If the season doesn't see 16 winners, the remaining spots will be filled based on the point standings.
When we looked at the format and where we could go and how could we continue to elevate the sport, we looked at wins. And we want our drivers talking about wins. That's what our fans like.
Once the postseason begins, the points reset for the drivers in the chase grid. NASCAR's new playoff will feature four rounds. A driver can guarantee advancement from one round to the next with a win. The Challenger round will consist of the first three races at Chicagoland, New Hampshire, and Dover, and help decide the 12 drivers who move on. Chase drivers who win any of those races automatically advance. The remaining spots will be filled based on points from those three races. Round two is the Contender round. Once again, the points for the chase drivers reset, and winning guarantees your advancement. Drivers will compete at Kansas, Charlotte, and Talladega, fighting to be one of the eight who advance to the next round. Spots not filled by race winners will be determined by the point totals from those three races. Round three is the Eliminator round. In this round, the remaining chase drivers race at Martinsville, Texas, and Phoenix. Race winners move on to the final round, and the remaining spots are determined by the point totals from those three races. All of this sets up the four-driver first-to-the-finish finale, the NASCAR Sprint Cup Series Championship at Homestead Miami Speedway. Points for the final four drivers reset once again, and bonus points for laps led will not apply. The chase driver with the best finish in the season finale will be crowned NASCAR's Sprint Cup Series champion.
With all the emphasis that's put on winning now, I think the fans are gonna really get a treat when the season unfolds.
All right, well, there you have it, and that is pretty much the outline, the breakdown of the new rules change in the NASCAR race. Josh, you heard what the changes are. Let's break it down by the numbers. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are Dale Earnhardt Sr. would punch Brian France in the face if he's still left. I am not a fan at all. I think they took the chase and trashed it. I don't know how you feel about it, Tom, but that almost makes me not want to watch NASCAR at all.
Well, let me ask you why you think that, because, you know, I'm going to take the, as usual, I'm going to take the opposite side of the spectrum with you on this. I think in this situation, if you're out there trying to qualify for every race and you win at least one race, your name is in the kitty. I think that the fact that we have more drivers in the chase allows there to be a deeper competition throughout the season. So I think that it's a good thing for fans, because a lot of times, let's look at it like this: how many times has your driver not been able to make it in just purely based on the point standing? At least at this opportunity, if they've tried to qualify for every race and they've won at least one race, you know, and let's face it, if you've not won any races, should you really be in the conversation of being in the chase anyway? So, you know, that said, yes, there are going to be our favorite drivers who never win a race, who shouldn't be in the chase for a championship. They call it a championship for a reason. And so if you can, it'd be like winning an NBA championship or a Super Bowl and never winning a game. So you have to win races to get into the chase. So there's some extra slots available now based on that ability. Now, certainly you're still going to see your usual suspects in the point chase races. So a lot of that's not going to change for you. If you're a Jimmy Johnson fan, for example, your situation, the way you're looking at things, probably not going to change at all. But perhaps maybe if you're a fan of like Ryan Newman or some drivers who won the Brickyard 400, maybe was struggling toward the end of the season, that would have counted a lot toward him being in the chase. And then also you look at the situation with Jeff Gordon getting really bumped into it. Situations that Jeff Gordon won some races. He got into the chase. So that's my thoughts on that. I think that you have that opportunity now for extra drivers to get into the races because they've done the right thing and to win races.
Well, I guess I can see that point of it, Tom, but don't forget they also changed the penalties structure. They changed qualifying. Instead of one car qualifying, now all 43 drivers going to be on the track at the same time for 25 minutes. They just changed too much in NASCAR at one point in time. And my question to Brian France would be, what happens if your driver doesn't make the 16? Next year, do you make it the top 32 in points to go to the chase? And then he still doesn't make it. Everybody goes in the chase?
Well,
he did it because of one driver.
Now, certainly you can't please everybody. And I think, really, the key changes to the penalty structures, really, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of fans might appeal to it. But maybe that's a lot of the disconnect with that is I would see your point on that. There's a lot of changing going on at one time. So, yeah, you know, as Dale Jr. joked a little bit about this week, why don't we just change everything in the sport at one time? So I get that. I understand that. And so, you know, you can't make everybody happy, but at least NASCAR's giving it an attempt. We got 6 days to Daytona. Daytona 500 countdown to the Daytona 500, the granddaddy of them all. That kicks off the season for the NASCAR racing season. So as we look forward into the 2014 season, here's what we've got to look forward to in 2014.
Hello everyone, welcome to our look ahead at the 2014 NASCAR Sprint Cup Series season. A season shaping up to be one of the most memorable in the sport's history.
Let's just go racing!
When the green flag drops in Daytona, Jimmy Johnson will start his pursuit of record-tying title number 7. The defending champion is coming off a season that featured 6 wins, one in which he never dropped lower than 3rd in the series standings. Johnson is already in elite company, but another title in 2014 would tie him with Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt. 2014 will also be a year of returns. 3-time champion Tony Stewart is scheduled to start his comeback in Daytona Beach. Stewart broke both bones in his lower right leg in the sprint car crash in Iowa last August. The wreck immediately ended his season, keeping him out of a race car for the rest of the year. Stewart, though, is about to be back and stronger than ever. Denny Hamlin, too, is coming off an injury-filled season that saw him miss four races. He finished 2013 with a win at Homestead and hopes to get back to championship form with the new season. The new year will bring a number of new faces to new places. Kevin Harvick is switching teams for the first time in his career, starting 2014 behind the wheel of the number 4 Chevrolet for Stewart Haas Racing. Harvick will join new teammate Kurt Busch, who also makes the jump to his new number 41. Busch's new ride means Martin Truex Jr. moves over to Furniture Row Racing. Ryan Newman also gets a fresh start for 2014, and the number 31 for Richard Childress Racing. 2014 will also feature one of the best rookie classes in recent memory, headlined by Nationwide Series champion Austin Dillon. Dillon is bringing back the historic number 3 to the Sprint Cup Series and will compete against names like Kyle Larson and Parker Kligerman for the Rookie of the Year title. 2014 comes with plenty of questions. Can Danica Patrick and Ricky Stenhouse improve after their rookie season? Will drivers like Matt Kenseth, Kyle Busch, and Dale Earnhardt Jr. carry the momentum of a great season into a new year? Can anyone stop Jimmy Johnson on his march toward history and title number 7? The 2014 season opens with the Sprint Unlimited on February 15th at Daytona International Speedway. The official start of the season is 8 days later, when the green flag drops on the 56th annual Daytona 500 on February 23rd.
Well, there you have it, $2 bill, Josh. Kind of a look into the 2014 season. A lot of different storylines. We see the comeback of Tony Stewart. We also see, obviously, Ryan Newman being with a different team. And we also are going to see Danica Patrick in a different fire suit. Does this fire suit make me look fast, Josh? I don't know. We're going to see what happens with Danica Patrick as well. A lot of new, as we just talked about, a lot of new rules going on in 2014. So a fresh look with a lot of the new cars, a lot of the new paint schemes. So real quickly, Josh, as we go through the storylines and we look at some of the big storylines or rumors or what have you going through NASCAR right now, what are some of the things you pick up on and extract from and opinions thereof, sir?
I'm incredibly angry, and I imagine there's another segment in NASCAR fans are that Austin Dillon would ever dare to drive the 3 car. Who does he think he is exactly? I hope he finishes dead last in every race, isn't competitive in any race, and in 2015 decides that's a bad idea. And Austin Dillon, you're going to get booed a whole lot at every single track you go to. So I hope you have thick enough skin to take it, and it's going to be really bad at Daytona. I don't know how you feel, Tom, but who does he think he is to drive the 3 car?
Well, you know, here's the thing. Yeah, I agree with you on that. I'm going to take a stand on that, in that the aspect that maybe some things should remain sacred, especially in the NASCAR world arena. And I would imagine that if anybody understands things that should remain sacred, is NASCAR. And I bet just about every NASCAR driver out there hated that American and a Beautiful Coca-Cola commercial during the Super Bowl. So that said, some things should remain sacred. But let's look at it like this from the other side of the coin. What an honor it is. Austin Dillon really certainly comes from a pedigree of racing. Obviously, his family was very, very tight with the Earnhardts. Also, Austin Dillon has proven himself on the track. Also, Austin Dillon really embraced the heritage of NASCAR, always has. And a lot of that is because of his upbringing. Certainly, a lot of people joke with him walk around the track with his cowboy hat that he wants to be like Kyle Petty. Well, there's only one Kyle Petty. There's only one Dale Earnhardt Sr. There's only one number 3 car. However, on the other side of the coin, I can see that maybe this is to honor Dale Earnhardt more as opposed to try to be Dale Earnhardt. Dale Earnhardt made the number three car famous, obviously using it to win six championships and the running number really until his death in 2001 there at Daytona. Which you're right, that's going to be some a tough thing for the true redneck Dale Earnhardt fans that say never touch the number three car. And have a memorial built in their house to Dale Earnhardt. Yes, those people are probably going to boo and make their voices very, very loud. And really, since 2001 race, the number three car has not appeared in a sprint car race since then. But 13 years after Dale Earnhardt's death, the number three car will return full-time in the Sprint Cup Series with rookie driver Austin Dillon, Richard Childress Racing, announced Wednesday, as we know, is his grandpa and also a very good friend of Dale Earnhardt Sr. So in one way, you could see this as being a way to honor a very dear friend.
Well, I suppose you're right. It could be a way to honor. But at the end of the day, I think Kyle Larson's the best rookie in the rookie class this year. Parker Klingerman's not going to do anything. Austin Dillon might win some races just because of the team he drives for. But going back to the chase, if we could for a minute, Tom, say you're Jimmy Johnson. You win the Daytona 500. You could conceivably goof off the next 25 races, start the race, drive 15 laps, get to 30, park the car, never risk damaging a race car, have 10 perfectly good cars lined up for the chase. NASCAR doesn't care. It's not about points anymore. You already got your win. Why bother to risk a car? Just start, get to 30th, park the car, and call the day.
Because they're competitors. That's exactly why. They're competitors. And really, where would that make sense for them to do that? I don't think we'll see that go on at all. I can see that conspiracy theories will fly, and that'll happen, especially if their driver doesn't get in. I mean, if their driver is not doing what they're supposed to. We always want to look to blame somebody. I say, hey, let's just see it play out. Obviously, here on the show, we're going to be talking a lot about racing coming up over the next year and the next season. Well, we got a couple other things in racing to talk about. We got to take a break, get on board here with some college hoops with Derek Schultz of the Schultz and Query Show. John Force, man, I tell you what, that man, you talk about an icon and a legend in the NHRA series. John Force flies to the national record. John Force raced to a national record time of 3.966 seconds. Count it, seconds, at 324.12 miles per hour in his Gastrol GTX Ford Mustang to lead the funny car qualifying at the season opening Circle K NHRA Winter Nationals Friday at the Auto Club Raceway at Pomona. Can't even speak today. I tell you what, and I tell you, there's a little race man's, if you want to call it, between one Ryan Hunter Ray and one little Force girl that we've had on the show as well. So congratulations to John Force. Man just continues to amaze me how a man his age, and he's been on this show. I really enjoy talking to John Force as well. IndyCar. I tell you what, Josh, IndyCar is going to be exciting here in Indianapolis. As we heard in the spot before this segment, the Indy road course, the Indianapolis Grand Prix is in place. We have the trophy. We have the course. We have everything in place for I'm sorry. You know, it's Graham Ray Hall. I apologize. Thank you, Michelle, for letting me know that. I did make an error on that. The Force girl is having a race manse with Graham Ray Hall, not Ryan Hunter Ray. That's my fault. Big mistake on my part. I do apologize, and I correct myself, and I move on. But, yeah, the Indianapolis Grand Prix here in Indianapolis, the road course. Josh, real quickly, this is going to be exciting for race fans that like the oval and the road course all on the same course in the same month. The month of May is going to be exciting here in Indianapolis.
It certainly will be exciting, and after me, you, and Michelle didn't get to go to any races together last year due to several different circumstances, we're going to get the band back together this year, Tom. We get to go to Indy Motor Speedway twice in the month of May.
Hey, man, we'll get the band back together. The Tom, Michelle, and $2 Bill Josh reunion tour at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Two races in May, of course. Then we've got the different races that happen in August around the Indianapolis, the Brickyard 400. An exciting time that it's going to be here at the Balance to Cover Racing. Well, guys, we got to take a break. My digit's 917-889-8516. If you want to talk some college hoops with myself, $2 Bill Josh, and Derek Schultz of the Schultz and Query Show, going to be joining us here shortly, right around the corner. We've got to take a break. Be right back.
For over 100 years, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has been the epicenter of racing, with the highest forms of motorsports all competing at Indy.
And Tony Kanaan has won the 97th running of the Indianapolis 500.
Over a century ago, the Speedway's designers had visions of a road course nestled inside the famed oval. And now, for the first time ever, the stars of the Indianapolis 500 will also run on the road course circuit.
It's so different than the Indy 500, I don't think it takes away from that. You can't even compare it to the oval. It's so different.
IndyCar drivers are the fastest and most versatile in the world. And now we'll be challenged by the 2.5-mile oval and the road course, both at the racing capital of the world.
Why not use this facility as much as you can? And this makes a lot of sense in my mind, and so if we have a chance to come here and race on the road course, hey, I'm all for it.
Next May, the racing action starts with the inaugural Grand Prix of Indianapolis.
It's pretty physical. There are a lot of fast corners. It's hard on your neck. Heavy braking into turn one. It's a good track.
This history-making event takes the green flag on Saturday, May 10, 2014. For the latest information, go to gpofindianapolis.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Timmons of U.S. Water Systems, a family-owned Indiana company that sells water treatment equipment around the world. But we especially know Indiana water because our world headquarters are right here in Indy. You have bad water in your home or business? Whether you're on city or well water, uswatersystems.com makes it easy to solve your water problems. We offer videos, all sorts of water conditioning equipment, and tech support 365 days a year by certified water specialists. U.S. Water has reverse osmosis systems, water softeners, and salt-free water conditioners from $179. Visit us at uswatersystems.com.
All right, my minions, welcome back to The Balance. My name is Saul Marquis, El Presidente. It is Saturday morning. I tell you what, how good was it to talk a little bit of racing again back here on The Balance after it always seems like a long season between racing when in their off season of racing, because obviously every Saturday morning we feature we talk racing, NASCAR, IndyCar, NHRA, some dirt racing, whatever. But we're back into the racing mode. We're back in the seat. Joining me also is $2 Bill Josh, my normal partner in crime, and also Mr. Derek Schultz of the Schultz and Query Show, 1260 AM local here. Derek, how are you doing, sir?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Man, if I was any better, I would be you, sir.
I don't know about that. I actually had an eye exam for the first time in 15 years, and I wore glasses as a kid, but I haven't been a glasses wearer since then, and they told me I need glasses, so now I've got this clunky pair of glasses on, and I'm enjoying my morning coffee during this call in here.
Hey, man, anything you got to do, I'm right there with you. I'm in denial. I am so blind. You know, I have a big screen TV, and I got to walk up to the TV just to see the channels. And it hasn't gotten that bad, but I'm with you, man, 45 years old, and I think I got to finally make a trip to the eye doctor. Well, guys, let's get into some college hoop talk, and let's talk about the Big Ten. Let's talk about IU. Let's talk about Purdue. $2 bill, Josh, I'll tell you what. What is going on with IU down in Bloomington? Win some, lose some, win some, lose some. They have got to get their act together. They are a lot more talented team this year than what they're showing on the court.
They absolutely are a lot more talented than they're showing. But, Tom, don't forget there's 33 freshmen and a sophomore in the Big Ten, which is always traditionally and probably always will be the most physical conference in college basketball. The referees always let the Big Ten be played the most physical. That's part of the reason they struggle when they get to March traditionally. It's part of the reason we haven't had the Big Ten National Championship since Michigan State is because they can't play physical in March. But Tom Crean, I'm an IU fan. I've talked to several of the IU fans. So they agree with me. I'm interested to get Derek's opinion. Make it to the tournament, or maybe it's time you and Fred Glass sit down and talk about where IU is going from here. Sure, you revive the program.
And Derek, I'll let you take that, because I know that, you know, here's the thing. I've been a major supporter of Tom Crean. I still am. And you know, we've had other people on this show that say, you know, hey, well, maybe Tom Crean isn't doing the best he can, but who are you going to get that's better? And really, with I don't know that we're to the point, if he doesn't make it to the NCAA tournament, that we're to the point of going on a job search. But certainly, IU fans, you know, we're okay with football losing because we're used to it. But we have to, as fans, with the Indiana Hoosiers, have to get to somewhere to play in March. And it seems like every year it falls short. So maybe there is a point there that at what point do we start looking at Tom Crean being the reason, Derek?
That's not even – I don't think that's even a discussion until the end of next year, and maybe that's too premature. Look, Indiana fans, it's a great fan base, but every once in a while they need to take some Prozac and just relax a little bit, because this team is a month – you know, a year removed from being number one last year. And look, I have some of the same criticisms of Crean that everybody else does. I think his bench rotation is way too deep. There is no reason to play 12 or 13 guys. I think he oversubs. I think at times, X's and O's wise, he's lacking, especially against some of the better coaches in the country. So all of the criticisms for Crean are warranted for the most part, but his job is not on the line. If Indiana bottoms out and doesn't make the tournament this year, there is no way that they would replace him. I think something that is interesting is after this year, his buyout, I read, drops by several million dollars. So it makes it much more reasonable if Indiana were to go that route after next year to buy Tom Crean out of his contract. But I think we're a long way away from having a serious discussion about that. But you mentioned IU's inconsistency. Look, outside of the state of Michigan, I can make the same argument about every single team in the Big Ten. You win one, you lose one, you win one, you lose one. That's what Ohio State's been doing. That's what Wisconsin's been doing. That's what Iowa's been doing. That's what Purdue's been doing. Everybody's been doing that in the Big Ten this year. It just shows how good the league is from top to bottom. But I really feel like this is a critical, critical game for Indiana, because Minnesota has lost three straight. They're not playing well. They're right for the picking. The Barn has not been a place where Indiana, or Purdue for that matter, has played well historically. But this is a chance to get a much-needed road win and even up that Big Ten record. And I think that they start feeling really good about themselves entering this stretch here, because you have Penn State coming at home, and then you have Iowa coming at home, coming up here. This is kind of an easy stretch, if you will, or I guess I shouldn't say easy, but a light stretch for IU to really get back on the right side of the bubble. Because if the season ended right now, they're certainly in the NCAA tournament conversation, but I don't believe that they would earn an at-large bid with what they've done so far.
Well, absolutely, and this is a key game today at 8 o'clock. And of course, I'm going to have to take myself off my new addiction to this Olympics, U.S. Olympics. I don't know. Maybe I'm the only guy out there that is, you know, I'm not into the figure skating, so I'm not cashing in my man card or anything like that. But I am into some of this snowboarding and some of the speed skating. And you know what? I kind of like I'm pushing a rock, pushing a rock, pushing a rock. But 8:15 tonight out at Minnesota. Obviously, Minnesota coming in at 15-8. The Hoosiers 14-8. This is a key win, and you're right, Derek. You nailed it on the head. This is a key win for Indiana, showing their fan base that they not only want to play in March. Everybody wants to play in March, but they deserve to play in March. And you're right, Derek. Maybe fans do need to take a little bit of a Prozac, but they have some huge anxiety problems. And IU, that's just IU basketball, and I guess that comes with the territory of IU and the pressure, quite frankly, that you have of coaching one of the best, having one of the best coaching jobs in the NCAA. Josh, the Indiana Hoosiers against the Golden Gophers today. Really, not a good showing the last time Indiana, and I thought it wasn't the best game Indiana could have played anyway against a team like Minnesota last time. So hopefully tonight they have the ability to redeem themselves.
They absolutely have the ability to redeem themselves. They're the more talented team. There's no question about who the more talented team is. The question I have is Richard Pitino at all. At the age of 31, I mean, he's the same age I am. As my boss told me the other day, my breath still smells like Similac. And as Richard Pitino's up at Minnesota. Richard Pitino at Minnesota, Minnesota fans, don't get real used to him. Don't delusion yourself. He's going to stay at Minnesota for the long term. His future is about 2.5 hours south of Indiana University. He's only there until his dad decides to hang it up, whenever that might be. So enjoy Pitino while you have him, but just know he's not staying there forever.
Well, let's move on to some Purdue, and I'm going to throw this out there to you, Derek. Matt Painter, same question. Are we having a conversation where Matt Painter isn't getting the job done at Purdue?
Yeah, I think that's at least a conversation at this point. I don't think his job's in any jeopardy for this year. But let's say that things continue to go south for Purdue. It looks like they're going to miss the tournament this year, barring something unforeseen. And let's say that they miss the tournament next year. Then I think it becomes a real, real conversation, because maybe the expectation level at Purdue isn't as high as it is in Indiana, but this still is an historically great program. And Gene Cady, I think, missed the tournament 4 times in 25 years. So it's not something that happens very often at Purdue. To miss it 3 years in a row, I think, is unacceptable. His problem, and Purdue's problem in general, is that they have the individual pieces. There's talent on the floor. This isn't like his team when he first inherited it from Katie in his first year in 05 and 06, when they had really nobody. They had Carl Landry and a bunch of football walk-ons. This team has talent. I mean, A.J. Hammonds is talented. Raphael Davis, I think, is talented. Tyrone Johnson was the top 50 recruit out of North Central. This freshman class, just in general, Basil Smotherman and Everett Stevens. Kendall Stevens. I keep wanting to call him his dad's name. These are talented guys. It's just that there's no cohesion. There's no flow. It's everybody that's kind of out there for himself. And some of the staples of boiler ball, if you will, is what their fans used to call it, defense and rebounding, that's just been real hit and miss, and it's been real inconsistent. And I think they need to get back to building that identity of Purdue basketball, which has been really lacking since Etuan Moore and Juwan Johnson, and then especially Robbie Hummel and Chris Kramer and guys like that left the program over the past couple of years. So I think that Purdue and Indiana are in similar situations in the fact that Tom Crean is looking to replace that group of players, Watford and Hulls and Zeller and Oladipo, and transition on to the next group. And Purdue is in the same sort of boat. Painter landed that one class in 07 with Martin, who ended up transferring, but Hummel and Moore and Juwan Johnson, these are three of the probably 10 best players in Purdue history, and he's never been able to replicate that. And I think what's especially frustrating, guys, and this is for all basketball fans in this state, is to look up north and see Michigan with Zach Irvin and Glenn Robinson, and Michigan State with Gary Harris, who was another Mr. Basketball, and Brandon Dawson of Gary, which had been a Purdue foothold in recruiting for years and years and years. That's where Glenn Robinson originally came from. And you see those guys, Indiana kids, being successful somewhere else while the two programs here are really struggling to find consistency. It's very frustrating.
Josh, and extremely frustrating. And we talk about Gene Cady and really he was the Bobby Knight of Purdue in a lot of ways, developed that program. He handpicked Matt Painter. You know, you can't blame everything on Matt Painter, but Josh, at some point, Matt Painter and Tom Crean, although Tom Crean does some very good recruiting, don't get me wrong, Derek makes a very good point. These Indiana kids aren't playing for Indiana schools. What do you think the reason for that is, Josh?
They want to win, and they want to win big. And right now, I hear Purdue's not getting it done. And if I could, Derek, I won't counter your point on Matt Painter. If I'm Morgan Burke and I could reach out to Wichita State somehow and I could find out that Greg Marshall would have interest in the Purdue job if we could make it available for him, and I'm not saying he would, but if he could, and you could find out that Marshall would in fact be interested, would you consider going ahead and saying, Matt Painter, I'm sorry, you're done before some other school hires Greg Marshall away?
There are two hurdles with that. One, Morgan Burke is notoriously cheap. And it's going to take a lot of money to pry away Greg Marshall, as it would for any hot coach. And two, no offense to Purdue, but if I'm Greg Marshall, my team's coming off a Final Four berth. They lost by 4 points to the eventual national champion. And I'm ranked top five, and I'm undefeated right now. And I've got the chance to get back to the Final Four for a second straight year, which would be unheard of. We've only seen Butler do that as far as a non-major school. I'm not setting my sights at Purdue. I'm not setting my sights for a middle-tier program. If I'm Greg Marshall, I'm looking for preeminent openings. Now, I'm not talking about like Duke and Kentucky and Kansas or something like that, but I'm looking right the level below that. And I think that there are better jobs and better situations out there for Greg Marshall than what he would have at Purdue, because it's so cutthroat. You're right in the middle of a really hot recruiting area because, yeah, you have Indianapolis that's kind of in your backyard, but so many programs come in here and pluck talent, like we mentioned with the Michigan schools, but Thad Matta has done it at Ohio State. Kentucky has gotten Indianapolis kids. Rick Pitino down at Louisville has gotten Indianapolis kids as well. So it's one of those things that I think most Purdue fans would say, yeah, you would love to see Greg Marshall, as would 95% of the programs in the country, as your head coach. But I just don't think him jumping to Purdue because of the financials and the logistics of it is a really realistic situation.
And guys, let's not forget that Indiana State played a great game against Wichita State, Greg Marshall's team, the other night. I don't know. I look at the inconsistent. Nothing against Indiana State, because they're a very good team this year, and they really are. But you think that you would expect more of a game from Wichita State than what you saw the other night against Indiana State, Derek?
No, because it's one of those things where in conference play, look, it's a long season, and these are 18 to 21-year-old kids. You're going to stub your toe here and there. I think just the fact that they have yet to lose a game is impressive in itself. I'm not going to pretend like going to Terre Haute is like going to Allen Fieldhouse and winning a game. But still, it's a tough place to play, and Indiana State's a good team. Solidly, I think, an NIT team at the very least. As style points and things like that, I'm not sure how much of that matters, and I'm sure coaches would tell you the same thing. Wichita went out of league, and they won at St. Louis, who's really good, one of the best teams in the A-10. They beat BYU on a neutral court, who's probably going to be an NCAA tournament team. They've swept Indiana State now. They beat Tennessee at home, who's on the bubble right now in the SEC. It's not like this is a team that is devoid of any good wins on their resume. It's not the greatest resume in the world, but they're sixth in the RPI. I think that's enough to be impressed with. I don't worry too much about how teams necessarily look and how they blow out other teams. I kind of look at what they put on the floor and if they can match up against other squads. And you look at Wichita State, and they've got a major team on the floor and major talent. Clay Anthony Early could play for a lot of teams. He's a guy that in that league, as good as the Missouri Valley is, nobody can counter somebody that is of that size or of that skill set. So Wichita State has a lot going for them. I think they're every bit the Final Four contender that their record indicates that they are.
Well, absolutely, and certainly this is the time of year where we start having that conversations. Who's going to get in? Who's not going to get in? Who's going to get in the NIT and so forth? And really, I don't know the whole system, and Derek, you might know a little bit better if it's just based on wins or losses or if it's based on strength of schedule. But if you look at strength of schedule, and if that plays a component in getting into the big dance, you got to look at Notre Dame really holding their own in the ACC. They're 12-11, 3-7 in the ACC, true. But they're playing teams like Syracuse, of course, North Carolina today. So strength of schedule, if that comes into a component, Derek, you got to look at Notre Dame possibly getting into the dance.
Yeah, it's a component, but you have to win some of the games. You can't just play a great schedule and be like, well, look at who we played, if you lose 75% of the games. And I think that's Notre Dame's problem. They just don't have enough wins. You know, having a 500 record overall about and being 3-7 in the league and having a sub-100 RPI, that's just not enough to get you in. And if you really look at what Notre Dame's done this year, the only team that they've beaten that is a slam-dunk NCAA team is Duke. Yeah, they beat IU on the neutral floor, but we don't even know if Indiana's going to make the tournament. So they've got a lot of good losses, if you will, teams that are good that they lost to. You know, Syracuse, Virginia, they lost to Ohio State at the Garden. They lost to Iowa on the road in the Big Ten ACC Challenge. So they've played a stacked schedule, and they've dealt with a lot of adversity, losing Grant and having some problems personnel-wise. But you have to win some of these games. I was actually part of the NCAA mock selection committee at the headquarters last year, and we sat down with the actual selection committee chair, Mike Babinski, and some of the folks at the NCAA, and we went through the process, and we actually, me and 20 other media members, filled out a bracket. We were there for 16 straight hours. It was kind of like a nerd fantasy camp for college basketball.
I'm jealous.
And we went through the checklist and what they look at and what they don't look at, and strength of schedule is absolutely part of the equation. But more than anything else, guys, just to put it simple, who did you beat? Where did you beat them? Who did you lose to? That's really what it's all about. That's the equation there. If you've beaten good teams and you've gone away from home and gone on neutral courts and won true road games, that's what impresses the committee, not necessarily just who you played.
Crazy scenario for you here. Again, this is just nerd fantasy talk here. IU goes to Syracuse, beats Syracuse, has the same record they have now, finishes. Do they get in?
Yeah, I think they do. Because right now, Joe Lunardi of ESPN has them as one of his first four out. And most of the projections I've looked at, Jerry Palm and some other guys, have them right on the cusp of the bubble. A win over Syracuse, who's arguably right now the best team in the country, on their true home court would certainly be enough to push a team that was on the fringe into the field.
Well, our true in-house groundhog, if he sees the shadow, can really predict. Hey, $2 Bill Josh is the only one in our entire crew that said Seattle was going to romp against Denver Broncos. So that said, $2 Bill Josh, I know this time of year you always like to put your witch's brew together, if you will. And sometimes it comes out right, but Josh's bracketology is a little off, but somehow at the end of the month, Josh, you always seem to have a good bracket. So as we look forward into March, give us your forecast, sir.
Well, I think the Final Four is going to be Syracuse, Michigan State, Florida, and not a lot of other people are going to say this right now. In fact, some people might say I'm drinking San Diego State Kool-Aid, or I think the Aztecs are going to make it. And, Derek, I'm glad you brought up St. Louis University. If I'm Fred Glass and I do at some point decide to get rid of Tom Crean, St. Louis's coach is an IU guy. I don't know if he played there. I know he spent several years coaching there. Derek, you might know, but I believe Jim Cruz spent some time playing at IU. But did he play there or did he just coach at IU?
No, I believe he just coached there. But he is if I'm not mistaken, I think he's an Evansville native. So he's an Indiana guy.
He is. I'll take that one. I'm from Evansville. He is from Evansville. Jim Cruz is. And loved and beloved down there, almost as much as Don Mattingly. Not quite, but almost. Well, hey, guys, let's get into this real quickly here because we've only got just a few more minutes, and I want to pick Derek's brain, because it certainly leads us into our next segment with our NBA talk. And I know, Derek, I told you 30 minutes, but you're more than welcome to hang out with us as we get into some NBA talk. But certainly we're here on Indiana Talks on our tape delay between 1 and 3 this afternoon. But so certainly we have a lot of Indiana affiliates and a lot of Indiana listeners. So we follow the Pacers very, very closely. What are your thoughts, and Josh, we'll get to you in a second, but I want to give this to Derek. Derek, what are your thoughts on Andrew Bynum, the Pacers? Was that a good pickup, a make-sense pickup, or is that a strategic move by Larry Bird?
I think that Bird and everybody else is lying if they say that keeping him away from Miami and other teams wasn't at least a fraction of the motivation for making that move. To me, it was just kind of one of those things where I shrugged my shoulders a little bit. I don't expect Bynum to have any kind of impact. If he gives them anything at all, I think that that's a positive, but I don't think that Bynum was the so-called missing piece of the championship team. The guy is a lazy malcontent, and generally those are the kind of players that don't push a team over the top. But all the Pacers are asking to do is to be an upgrade for Jan Mahimi. I think it's a different situation in the fact that since he's left Los Angeles, teams have acquired him hoping that he could be the centerpiece, hoping that he could be a franchise center. That's what Philadelphia did as part of the Dwight Howard trade. That's what why they were motivated to make that move. They thought they could get Bynum and he could be their franchise center for the next 5-6 years. Cleveland threw money at him, and they smartly gave themselves some outs in that contract in case he didn't fulfill that promise. But Cleveland signed him this offseason, hoping that he'd be a franchise center. And the Pacers look at this as they're taking a flyer. It's $1 million. They can cut him at any time. You keep him away from Miami, and you hope that he can do better than Jan Mahimi, which if he is motivated, if he tries, you would think that just him getting out there on the court, he'd be a better player than Jan Mahimi. So I didn't like the move. My first reaction was, no, you don't want somebody to come in and maybe mess up the chemistry and be a locker room problem. But the more and more I've looked at it, I've come around to the fact that all they're asking him to do is be a backup center, and you keep him away from Miami in the process. So I think slightly I'll put the scale to a positive move for the Pacers. But still, guys, I don't expect Bynum to be this guy that's going to come in and give him like 12 and 10 in 15 minutes or something crazy and have this huge impact.
So, Derek, what's your thoughts on the Lance Stevens story? Because Tom having a little bit of technical difficulty. I mean, that's the Lance Stevens story, the Paul George story. You familiar with it? Do you have any thoughts on it?
Well, the Paul George story is unfortunate. It's something that every once in a while we see athletes run into. I'm not going to speak about, you know, the rumors of what he may have offered her and some of the things like that. But, you know, guys make mistakes. People in life do things that they regret, and this is probably one of those situations that he would like to forget. What I'm worried about is that if it affects his game, because he commented on it yesterday for the first time publicly, and then he went out and had one of his worst games of the entire season last night. What did he shoot, like 4 of 21? He was awful against Portland. They were really fortunate to win that game. So as long as it doesn't creep into his head, it's not something that I'm really worried about. As far as Lance is concerned, I think the Pacers should just shut him down through the All-Star break and let him heal up. They've got a real manageable schedule here with Denver coming in on, I think, Monday, and then they have Dallas on Wednesday, and then they have Orlando on Sunday night, who's a bad basketball team, even though they just beat Oklahoma City. So I think you might as well just shut him down, let him get the full week of rest and come back so this isn't something that pops up later on, because the Pacers are in a position right now where they don't have to have their foot on the gas all the time. They're 3 games clear in the loss column of Miami. And the Heat right now are in the middle of a really tough road trip where they're going to take on some more losses. So you need to have Lance down the stretch. He's a big X factor, and you don't want these lower back problems to be popping up come May and June.
Hey, guys, real quickly here. Can you all hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I do not know what happened. And Derek, I know you're a radio guy. I lost everybody in my ears. So I hope you guys didn't think I was being rude to you. But, you know, well, I lost everything in my ears, so I couldn't hear anybody talking. So I do apologize if I talked over to you. But I think I am back now, everybody. Josh, can you hear me?
Yes. And the last question I was going to ask you, Derek, is, you know, the trade deadline is February 20th. That's 12 days from now. There's been a lot of talk about Kyle Lowry to the Pacers. Even heard a little bit of Deion Waiters to the Pacers. Do you think the Pacers should make a trade? Because all the trades I hear say they would trade Granger and George Hill, which I don't know if I agree with. Do you think they'll make anything, or do you think they should?
No. No. The answer to that question is no and no. No, I don't think that they're going to make a move, and no, I don't think they should make a move. Because I don't think that Kyle Lowry is that good of an upgrade, if an upgrade at all, or any of the moves out there that I've heard. I mean, you know, you want to talk about Rajon Rondo, then yeah, that's intriguing, but he's a guy that Boston seems hell-bent on keeping. So he was the only guy that would pique my interest at all. But you saw it last night. I mean, George Hill, 37 points. He's not a guy that is asked to do a whole lot. People look at him statistically, and they say, well, geez, George Hill, man, he's the weak link of the starting five. There are a ton of good NBA players that would look like the weak link in a starting five surrounded by David West, Roy Hibbert, Paul George, and Lance Stephenson. Those are four great players. So, yeah, of course George Hill is the weak link. That doesn't make him awful. It doesn't make him Scott Haskin. It just means that, you know, he's the worst of those five players. Three of those guys have been all-stars in their career, and the other one should have been an all-star this year and got snubbed. So I think George Hill becomes everybody's punching bag. And he's not going to go out and have an effort like he had last night on a regular basis or anything like that. But I think that you're just fine with George Hill as your point guard. And the beauty of this Pacers team is that with this starting five, last night is a perfect example. Roy Hibbert did nothing last night. 2 of 8 from the field, he scored 4 points. Paul George shot like 4 of 21. You were without Lance Stephenson. And here you have David West step up and score 30, who has also struggled statistically this season. You have George Hill pour in 37 points. You lose 60% basically of your starting five against a really good Portland team, and you're able to beat them because your fourth and fifth guys step up to the plate. And that's what this team is. It's as much as we want to fawn over Paul George and his offense and Roy Hibbert and his defense, this is still a sum of their parts team. What makes them great is that they have five great players. They have the best starting five in the league. So I don't know if you want to go in and mess that up. And Granger, I think, has given them more than I expected him to give. And the second unit, even though it's been hit and miss at times, is good enough. I think they're just fine moving forward with what they have, and tinkering with it any more than they already have, I think, would be a mistake.
All right, well, we've been joined by Derek Schultz of the Schultz & Quarry Show, 1260 AM, local here.